of rock salt, the growing salt industry gained the economic importance to persuade the government to construct canals. Between 1713 and 1741, the government built a network of waterways linking the salt works with the Mersey. By the end of the century, salt refineries were being established along the Mersey, and a salt warehouse was built on the Liverpool docks. Coal from South Lancashire on the opposite bank of the Mersey could be transported cheaply by barge. The salt industry, the coal industry, and the port of Liverpool fed off of each other and together grew prosperous. Unfortunately for Scotland, Cheshire achieved its new position of power and influence just in time to effect Scotland's union with England in 1707. After James II, a Catholic, was deposed in England, Presbyterianism was guaranteed for Scotland, and the last obstacle to unification was removed. The Scottish and English parliaments merged. But adding Scotland meant bringing Scottish salt into England, and Cheshire merchants had added to the Treaty of Union numerous stipulations on salt production and pricing aimed at preventing Scottish salt from competing with Cheshire. This was one of several reasons the Union had an acrimonious beginning. Almost 30 years before they were joined, John Collins had warned that unless moderated in its customs, salt competition would breed enmity between England and Scotland. Meanwhile, Cheshire salt makers would not give up on the idea that the coal beds around them extended to their region. As late as 1899, they drilled a shaft a mile deep. But again, they found only salt. Even before true industrialization had overtaken England, the industrial degradation of the environment was an accepted way of life in Cheshire. Cheshire merchants would look with pride at the sky, blackened 24 hours a day from clouds of smoke from the salt pan furnaces, and note the industriousness of their region. The forests of Cheshire had been chopped down to fuel furnaces. Barren white scars were etched into the pasture land, where the pan scale, the residue that had to be periodically chipped off the salt pans, was dumped. And the earth itself was beginning to collapse. In 1533, it was reported that the land near Cumbermere, Cheshire, had fallen in, creating a pit that filled with salt water. In 1657, another little salt pond appeared at Bickley. In 1713, a hole appeared just south of Winsford in a place called Weaver Hall. All of these funnel-shaped holes were in proximity to salt production, and they all immediately filled with brine. Many locals believed that the holes were the result of abandoned salt mines collapsing. But mining interests pointed out that the sinkholes were not appearing near abandoned shafts. By the last 2 decades of the 18th century, when a new hole sunk every year or two, it started to appear that there was a relationship between the increasing quantities of salt being produced and the collapsing of the earth. Despite Cheshire's growing production, England still had that same dangerous dependence on foreign salt that had worried Queen Elizabeth. During the 17th and 18th centuries, it was a recurring topic of concern, especially since much of the foreign salt came from England's principal enemy, France. On land campaigns, each British soldier received a huge ration of salt so that he could acquire fresh meat along his march and salt it to use as needed. The British Navy was provisioned with salt and salt foods. Salt was strategic, like gunpowder, which was also made from salt. In 1746, Thomas Lowndes, a Cheshire native, wrote a book-length report to the Admiralty on developing Britain's own sea salt supply. After studying French and Dutch salt, he, with great excitement, announced that he had discovered the secret of superior salt. This is the process. Let a Cheshire salt pan, which commonly contains about 800 gallons, be filled with brine to within about an inch of the top. Then make and light the fire, and when the brine is just lukewarm, put in about an ounce of blood from the butcher's, or the whites of 2 eggs. Let the pan boil with all possible violence. As the scum rises, take it off. When the fresh or watery part is pretty well decreased, throw into the pan the third part of a pint of new ale, or that quantity of bottoms of malt drink. Upon the brine's beginning to grain, throw into it the quantity of a small nutmeg of fresh butter. And when the liquor has salted for about half an hour, that is, has produced a good deal of salt, draw the pan. In other words, take out the salt. By this time the fire will be greatly abated, and so will the heart of the liquor. Let no more fuel be thrown on the fire, but let the brine gently cool till one can just bear to put one's hand into it. Keep the brine of that heat as near as possible, and when it has worked for some time and is beginning to grain, throw in the quantity of a small nutmeg of fresh butter, and about 2 minutes after that, scatter through the pan, as equally as may be, 1 ounce and 3/4 of clean, common alum, pulverized very fine. And then instantly, with the common iron scrape pan, stir the brine very briskly in every part of the pan for about 1 minute. Then let the pan settle, and constantly feed the fire, so that the brine may never be quite scalding hot, nor near so cold as lukewarm. Let the pan stand, working thus, for about 3 days and nights, and then draw it. The brine remaining will by this time be so cold that it will not work at all. Therefore fresh coals must be thrown upon the fire, and the brine must boil for about 30 minutes, but not near so violently as before the first drawing. Then with the usual instrument take out such salt as is beginning to fall, as they term it, and out it apart. Now let the pan settle and cool. When the brine becomes no hotter than one can just bear to put one's hand into it, proceed in all respects as before, only let the quantity of alum not exceed 1 ounce and 1/4, and in about 48 hours after, draw the pan. Thomas Lowndes, Brine Salt Improved, or The Method of Making Salt from Brine That Shall Be as Good or Better than French Bay Salt, 1746. Lowndes assured the Admiralty, "The greater the quantity is of salt made my way, the more satisfied the public will be that my secret is truly made known." But understandably some found his secret to be excessive for just making salt, a product whose commercial success depended on low production costs. 2 years later, the physician William Brownrigg, in a widely distributed book, The Art of Making Common Salt, criticized Lowndes's formula, writing that a purer and stronger salt can be made, and at less expense. Cheshire salt needed to be not only better, but even more important, cheaper. Almost 75 years earlier, Dr. Thomas Rastell of Droitwich had written that Droitwich had simplified salt-making, eliminating the cost of blood used in Cheshire brine by making an egg-white scum, a technique still used in cooking to remove impurities in meat stocks for a clear aspic. For clarifying, we use nothing but the whites of eggs, of which we take 1/4 of a white and put it into 1 gallon or 2 of brine, which being beaten with the hand, lathers as if it were soap, a small quantity of which froth, put into each vat, raises all scum, the white of 1 egg clarifying 20 bushels of salt, by which means our salt is as white as anything can be. Neither has it any ill savor, as that salt has that is clarified with blood. For granulating it, we use nothing, for the brine is so strong itself that unless it be often stirred, it will make salt as large-grained as bay salt. Dr. Thomas Rastell, 1678. The goal was always to make bay salt, salt that resembled the sea salt of Bourgneuf Bay, because this was the salt of the fisheries. Lowndes mentioned in his treatise that he had received a letter from a Captain Masters, dated June 5, 1745, estimating that the Newfoundland cod fishery used at least 10,000 tons of salt annually. Between 1713 and 1759, through nearly global warfare with France, England had acquired most of the codfish grounds of North America. The English were excited about their new cod potential, but even a decade before they had achieved their greatest victories, Brownrigg had warned that in order to take advantage of the acquisition of Cape Breton alone, the French end of Nova Scotia, England would have to increase its supply of salt. North American cod seemed limitless, and the only impediments to British profits were the number of ships and fishermen, and the supply of salt. Chapter 12. American Salt Wars. Studying a road map of almost anywhere in North America, noting the whimsical non-geometric pattern of the secondary roads, the local roads, the map reader could reasonably assume that the towns were placed and interconnected haphazardly, without any scheme or design. That is because the roads are simply widened footpaths and trails, and these trails were originally cut by animals looking for salt. Animals get the salt they need by finding brine springs, brackish water, rock salt, any natural salt available for licking. The licks found throughout the continent were often a flat area of several acres of barren, whitish-brown or whitish-gray earth. Deep holes, almost caves, were formed by the constant licking. The lick at the end of the road, because it had a salt supply, was a suitable place for a settlement. Villages were built at the licks. A salt lick near Lake Erie had a wide road made by buffalo, and the town started there was named Buffalo, New York. When Europeans arrived, they found a great deal of salt-making in North American villages. In 1541, Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto, traveling up the Mississippi, noted, "The salt is made along a river, which, when the water goes down, leaves it upon the sand. As they cannot gather the salt without a large mixture of sand, it is thrown into certain baskets they have made for the purpose, made large at the mouth and small at the bottom. These are set in the air on a ridgepole, and water being thrown on, vessels are placed under them wherein it may fall. Then being strained on the fire, it is boiled away, leaving salt at the bottom." Hunter groups that did not farm did not make salt. An exception was the Bering Strait Eskimo, who took reindeer, mountain sheep, bear, seal, walrus, and other game and boiled it in seawater to give a salty taste. Many, such as the Penobscot, Menominee, and Chippewa, never used salt before Europeans arrived. Jesuit missionaries in Huron country complained that there was no salt, though one missionary suggested that Hurons had better eyesight than the French, and attributed this to abstinence from wine, salt, and other things capable of drying up the humors of the eye and impairing its tone. The Puget Sound Indians, whose diet was largely salmon, were said to eat no salt. The Mohegan of Connecticut ate great quantities of lobster, clams, shad, lamprey, and also corn, but according to Cotton Mather, they had not a grain of salt in the world until we bestowed it on them. But the Delaware salted their cornmeal. The Hopi boiled beans and squash with salt and served jackrabbit that was stewed with chili peppers and wild onions in salted water. The Zuni served boiled salted dumplings in a brine sauce and made kushewe, a salty bread of lime and salted suet. When a Zuni traveled, he always carried a jar or earthen box of salt along with one of red chili, a blend that would remain a classic seasoning of the Southwest. In the seventh month of their year, the Aztecs observed ceremonies for Vixtlacehuatl, who was banished to the salt waters by her brothers, the rain gods, and thus she was the discoverer of salt, the inventor of salt-making. The 16th-century Spanish friar Bernardino de Sahagún described her appearance. Ears of gold, yellow clothes, an iridescent green plumage, and a fishnet skirt. She carried a shield trimmed with eagle, parrot, and quetzal feathers, and she beat time with a cane topped by incense-filled paper flowers. The girl chosen to represent Vixtlacehuatl danced for 10 days with women who had made salt. Finally, on the festival day, 2 slaves were killed, and then the girl, too, was sacrificed. Many indigenous North American cultures have a salt deity, almost always female. For the Navajo, it is an elderly woman. Among agricultural people of the U.S. Southwest and Mexico, Expeditions to gather salt were often initiated with great ceremonies. Among the Hopi, this included copulation with a woman designated the Salt Woman. Among many southwestern groups, salt gathering was organized by religious leaders. Usually, participants had to be initiated into a cult of salt gatherers. Often only members of a privileged clan, such as the Laguna's Parrot Clan, could go on salt expedition. In most cultures, only men were allowed to gather salt, but the Navajo allowed women also. The Zuni, according to legend, originally allowed both, but their frivolity on the mission offended the salt goddess, and the salt supply started to vanish. So they changed the custom to men only. The entire Zuni population prayed for the safe return of the salt expedition. When the men returned, the paternal aunt of each salt gatherer would wash his head and body with yucca suds. The history of the Americas is one of constant warfare over salt. Whoever controlled salt was in power. This was true before Europeans arrived, and it continued to be the reality until after the American Civil War. As on the Italian peninsula, all the great centers of civilization on the American continents were founded in places with access to salt. The Incas were salt producers with salt wells just outside Cusco. In Colombia, nomadic tribesmen probably first built permanent settlements because they needed salt and learned how to make it. Their society was organized around natural brine springs. The Chibcha, a highland tribe living in the area that was to become the modern capital of Bogota, became a dominant group because they were the best salt makers. In yet another example of the association between sex and salt for the 20th century psychologists to ponder, the Chibcha salt lords honored the gods two times a year by abstaining from sex and salt. As in Africa, the Chibchas made salt by evaporating brine into cone shapes. Befitting a multi-class society, various grades of salt were produced, from the whitest for the rich to a black, unpleasant-tasting salt for the poor. All the natural brine springs of the Chibcha were owned by the monarch, the Zipa, who ruled by virtue of his ability to distribute salt. When the Spanish came, having an understanding of the power of kings, they took over the brine springs and declared them property of their king, thus destroying the authority of the Zipas. According to Bernal Diaz, the chronicler of Hernan Cortes' conquest, the Aztecs made salt from evaporating urine. The tribe in Honduras plunged hot sticks into the ocean and scraped off the salt, just as the Romans had observed the Britons doing. More commonly, brine from natural springs was evaporated, or desert salt beds were scraped like the sebkas of the Sahara, or sea salt was raked from the ocean's edges. The Aztecs controlled the salt routes by military power, and were able to deny their enemies, such as Tlalacaltecas, access to salt. William Prescott's 1819 classic, History of the Conquest of Mexico, described the Aztecs receiving tribute from their subjects. 2,000 loaves of very white salt, refined in the shape of a mold, for the consumption only of the lords of Mexico. The Spanish took power by taking over the salt works of the indigenous people they conquered. Cortes, who came from southern Spain, not far from both Spanish and Portuguese salt works, understood the power and politics of salt. He observed with admiration how the Tlatoque had maintained their independence and avoided the oppression of the Aztecs by abstaining from salt. They ate no salt because there was none in their land, he wrote, and like the British, they feared salt dependency. The earliest evidence that has been found of Mayan salt production is dated at about 1000 BC, but remains of earlier salt works have been found in non-Mayan Mexico, such as Oaxaca. It may be an exaggeration to claim that the great Mayan civilization rose and fell over salt. However, it rose by controlling salt production and prospered on the ability to trade salt, flourishing in spite of constant warfare over control of salt sources. By the time Europeans arrived, the civilization was in a state of decline, and one of the prime indicators of this was a breakdown in its salt trade. The Mayan world extended from Yucatan to the present-day Mexican state of Chiapas and across Guatemala. When Hernán Cortés first went to the Yucatan Peninsula in the early 16th century, he found a Mayan people with a large salt industry and an extensive trade not only in salt, but in salted goods, such as salt fish and cured hides. The Mayans used salt as medicine mixed with marjoram and hull tree leaves for birth control, with oil for epilepsy, with honey to lessen childbirth pains. It was also used in rituals associated with both birth and death. In the Yucatan, salt was made from solar evaporation at least 2,000 years ago, meaning that indigenous Americans have been making solar evaporated sea salt for at least as long as have Europeans. The Mayans also knew how to extract salt from plants, although plant salt is usually potassium chloride rather than sodium chloride. They would burn plants, certain types of palms as well as grasses, and soak their ashes into a brine that was then evaporated. This technique was practiced by isolated forest people throughout the Americas and in Africa. The Lacandon of Chiapas are an isolated and culturally distinct Mayan group who lived self-sufficiently in a rainforest that, unfortunately for them, became the Mexican-Guatemalan border. They made salt from burning a certain species of palm, and they used this salt as money. Dressing in long white gowns, the Lacandon paddled canoes in their rainforest and lived an undisturbed and unique way of life until the 20th century, when the modern Mexican and Guatemalan states became concerned about the international border running through the Lacandon forest. For the military, the forest made the border more difficult to guard. For some Lacandons, the forest was a source of wealth, and they sold the hardwood trees to lumber companies. The tribe began losing its traditions and self-sufficiency as their forest disappeared. Because the logging companies supplied them with salt, Lacandons stopped burning palms. Typical of the cultural destruction of Chiapas Mayans, the town of La Concordia and its surrounding salt works were flooded by a dam in the 1970s and now rest on the bottom of a lake. According to Frans Blom, the Danish anthropologist who explored Mayan culture in the 1920s through the 1940s, the site contained the unique salt works of the Mayan highlands, where brine was diverted from springs by the use of tree trunks into shallow stone pans for solar evaporation, similar to the Hawaiian technique using stone bowls. The people of La Concordia placed reeds in the evaporation pans, often shaped into six-pointed stars. Crystals would form on the reeds, making thick, sparkling white ornaments that salt makers sold to be used as religious offerings. By Blom's time, the Mayans were bringing these offerings to Catholic churches. By coincidence, Cheshire salt workers had a similar tradition. At Christmas time, they placed branches in evaporation pans until salt crystallized like a fresh snowfall, and they brought these snowy branches home for Christmas decorations. The arrival of the Spanish meant not only a new power controlling the salt, but a huge increase in demand for industrial salt. The Spanish introduced herds of cattle that needed to be fed salt, and whose hides were cured with salt in a prosperous leather industry. Obsessed with the extraction of precious metals, the Spanish invented the patio process for silver mining in mid-16th century Mexico. In this process, silver was separated from ore by using salt because the sodium in the salt extracted impurities. Silver mining by the patio process required huge quantities of salt, and the Spanish built large-scale salt works adjacent to silver mines. The Yucatan Peninsula has a climate particularly well-suited for salt production, and geographically is particularly well-suited for trade, with its proximity to the Caribbean and Central America. It was the largest salt producer in pre-Columbian America and remained a leader when the Spanish took it over. The Spanish, unable to locate precious metal deposits in the Yucatan, began to look for ways of earning state revenue from the Yucatan salt works. The Spanish crown proposed various salt taxes, but this made the salt there more expensive and it could not compete in Cuba with British salt. Cuba, a Spanish colony, should have been a Spanish market. But a time came in the 19th century with the wild fluctuation of salt prices when Yucatan salt was imported to England through the port of Liverpool. The British first arrived in North America in the north, at Newfoundland, and they took cod. They next arrived in the south, the Caribbean, where they took salt, which they needed for the cod. Only after they had a significant population of colonists in between did they think of America as a market in which to sell Liverpool salt. To the British Admiralty, the solution to a lack of sea salt was to acquire through war or diplomacy places that could produce it. Portugal had both sea salt and an important fishing fleet, but needed protection, especially from the French, who were regularly seizing their fishing boats. And so England and Portugal formed an alliance, trading naval protection for sea salt. The Portuguese alliance gained England access to the Cape Verde Islands, where British ships could fill their holds with sea salt on their way across the Atlantic. The islands on the eastern side of the archipelago, Mayo, Boa Vista, and Sal, which means salt, had marshes with strong brine, and in the 17th century Portugal granted the British exclusive use of the salt marshes of Mayo and Boa Vista. British ships had only from November until July to make salt before the summer rains ruined the brine. They usually stopped off in January, anchoring off Mayo, which they called May Island. From there, the sailors would row their launches less than 200 yards to a broad beach. Behind the beach was a salt marsh, where a mile-long stretch of ponds would be 8 inches deep in brine. It could take months before the sailors had scraped enough salt crystals for the ship to be full. Sometimes early rains would force them to leave. Some ships had to go to Boa Vista because they found too many crews already working at Mayo. At Boa Vista, the brine was weaker and took longer to crystallize, and the anchorage was farther out, forcing the sailors to row a mile to bring salt to the ship. But sea salt was valuable enough for a shipload of it to be worth the labor of an entire ship and crew for several months. In the 17th and 18th centuries, while European powers were fighting bitterly for Caribbean islands on which to grow sugarcane, northern Europeans, the English, the Dutch, the Swedish, and the Danes, also looked for islands with inland salt marshes like the Cape Verde Islands. In 1568, under William of Orange, the Dutch began an 80-year independence struggle against Spain, which cut them off from Spanish salt. But in the Americas, the Dutch could come ashore unobserved on the coast of Venezuela at Araya, a hot and desolate 80-mile lagoon, and steal Spanish salt from the beach, where Caribbean seawater evaporated into a thick white crust. The Dutch also got salt from Bonaire in the nearby Dutch Antilles. The British gathered salt illegally from the Spanish on another small island in the area called Tortuga, or Salt Tortuga, which is today part of Venezuela. They also made salt on Anguilla, and the Turks Islands, which had the advantage of being closer to North America, where the cod fishery was. They would stop off in one of the salt islands, and as in the Cape Verdes, the sailors themselves would scrape up salt and load up their ships and sail on to New England, Nova Scotia, or Newfoundland. Fearing enemy warships and pirates, the salt ships traveled in convoys. They also did this in Europe for the same reasons. Huge armed fleets of ships of various nationalities would anchor off L'Aquasique while salt was being loaded. Sailors were not allowed to be armed when they came ashore because if convoys of two nations arrived at the same time, a port scuffle could turn into a land war. English and Dutch sailors were especially hostile toward each other. At the end of winter, fleets of several dozen British ships, accompanied by warships, would meet in Barbados. There they would combine into one large fleet and choose a commander. Then they would go to one of the salt islands, usually Tortuga, and the crews would work for months to load their ships. If the fleet was too large, or if it was a wet year, there would not be enough salt to fill all the ships, and since they were only together as a temporary arrangement, They would compete, working as fast as possible, each ship trying to secure a full hold. Then they would sail north together, and when they believed they were out of danger, especially from the Spanish fleet, each would veer off on its own course. In 1684, when Bermuda, first explored by the British more than 150 years earlier, finally became a British colony, the first governor was given instructions to proceed to rake salt. English ships sailing to American colonies could stop off in this cluster of minuscule islands in the middle of the Atlantic, some 600 miles from the coast of North America, and pick up salt for the fisheries. It was a chance to make Bermuda productive. But the climate in Bermuda was not warm and sunny enough for a successful sea salt operation. What Bermuda did have was cedar. So Bermudians, most of whom were originally sailors from Devon, built small, fast sloops out of cedar. Until the early 18th century, when New England fishermen invented the schooner, the Bermuda sloop, with its single mast and enormous spread of sails, was considered the fastest and best vessel under sail, capable of outrunning any naval ship. These sloops dominated the trade between the Caribbean and North American colonies and were even used in the Liverpool to West Africa trade. In the Caribbean, the leading cargo carried to North America, more tonnage than even sugar, molasses, or rum, was salt. The leading return cargo from North America to the Caribbean was salt cod, used to feed slaves on sugar plantations. In the southern part of the Bahamas chain and the group south of it, known as the Turks and Caicos, salt rakers found small islands with brackish lakes in the interior. Great Inagua, Turk, South Caicos, and Salt Key had salty inland lakes well suited for salt making. Since Columbus and his Spanish successors had already annihilated the indigenous population, these scarcely inhabited islands were easily converted into salt centers. Great Inagua was first raked by the Spanish and Dutch. After the Spanish killed the few local tribesmen, it was an uninhabited island, and sailors from various nations stopped by and filled their ships. The Spanish named it Inagua, meaning in water. In 1803, salt rakers from Bermuda built a small town, Matthew Town, by the edge of a salt pond at one end of the flat grassy island. First came salt rakers who simply scraped up what had evaporated on the edge of ponds. The crew would be dropped off on the island, where they would spend a few months, or sometimes as long as a year, gathering salt while the captain and three or four slaves would sail off, fishing for sea turtle, scavenging shipwrecks, and trading with pirates or between islands. Sometimes they would hide in coves by treacherous rocks or uncharted shoals and wait, or even lure the ships onto the rocks so they could scavenge them. An 18th century Bermuda governor complained that the Caicos trade did not fail to make its devotees somewhat ferocious, for the opportunities were in picking, plundering, and wrecking. He was also concerned with the practice of sending the slaves plundering while the free sailors were gathering salt. The governor wrote, "The Negroes learned to be public as well as private thieves." When the captain and his slaves had finished with their profitable adventures months later, they would return and pick up their crew and a full hold of salt to sell in the North American colonies. In the 1650s, British colonists from Bermuda sailed down to Grand Turk, a small desert island, and Salt Key, its tiny neighbor, only 2 miles long by 1.5 miles wide. In Salt Key, passing ships would stop to rake the ponds that occupied one-third of the island. In the 1660s, Bermudians began exploiting it more systematically, at first only in the summers, which were dry. By 1673, the arrival of Bermudian rakers on Salt Key was a regular event. 5 years later, salt raking had become equally well organized on the slightly larger island to the north, Turk, or Grand Turk Island, which was named after a native cactus thought to resemble a Turkish turban. But the Spanish would come in the winter and take the salt rakers' tools and destroy their sheds. By the early 1700s, Bermudians started living full-time on Salt Key to protect their property. No one knows when the small harbor was built with its stone piers, but it was the most storm-proof in the Turks and Caicos, a safe shelter for ships to spend a few weeks loading. But as vessels became larger, the little harbor was too shallow, and light ships had to be used to carry the salt out to mother ships anchored offshore. Salt Key saltmakers built a system of ponds and sluices. Every year they had to spend weeks overhauling the system. The ponds had to be drained in order to mend the stone or clay bottoms so that they would hold water and not crumble into the salt. Then the ponds would be refilled for the slow process of solar evaporation. Saltmakers came from Bermuda and built large stone houses in the Bermudan style, with thick walls to hold up a cut stone roof built in steps like a pyramid. The heavy roof was designed to resist hurricanes. Mahogany furniture was brought to the island. These were the manor houses of slave plantations, but they had none of the elegance of the Virginia tobacco or Alabama cotton or West Indian sugar planters' homes. The saltmaker's house had an eastern porch that looked out over his salt ponds and a western porch that looked over his loading docks. The houses were always built at the water's edge by a loading dock. The salt, too valuable to entrust to anyone else, was kept in the basement, which was one story below ground, but the windowless first story of the house had no floor, so that actually each house had a two-story storage bin at its base. Salt was the salt maker's wealth, and they watched over it day and night. Windmills pumped the seawater through successive ponds, and the mills and sluices were maintained by a blacksmith shop at the house. Slave grew some vegetables in gardens, but the soil became poorer and poorer as the trees were all chopped down to fuel salt pans. The island was hot and dry and naked, and food and even fresh water were becoming increasingly scarce. In 1790, a man named Stubbs, who had left the North American colonies because he remained loyal to British rule, sent for his brother, Thomas Stubbs, and settled in Providenciales, an island in the Turks and Caicos. The Stubbs family were salt producers in Cheshire, but Thomas and his brother wanted to start a new life as West Indian planters. They called their plantation Cheshire Hall and tried to grow sisal, a hemp substitute from the fibers of the agave plant. But sisal growing at Cheshire Hall was a failure. Then they tried to grow Sea Island cotton, but that failed also. On these flat, arid little islands, everything failed, except salt. Saltmakers brought in livestock, donkeys to haul carts of salt to the wharves, and cattle to feed themselves as they made salt. All that these small, salt-making islands had was their location in shipping lanes, sunshine, and marshes that trapped seawater. Yet for a time, they prospered because the British Empire needed salt. Chapter 13. Salt and Independence. The English, the Dutch, and the French hunted for salt, the magic elixir that could turn their new American seas of limitless fish into limitless wealth. The Dutch gave incentives to colonists, and in 1660 granted a colonist the right to build salt works on a small island near New Amsterdam, known as Coney Island. The French learned from the indigenous people the location of licks, springs, and marshes. They used many existing salt works, including those at Onondaga, New York, and Shawneetown, Illinois. In 1614, Captain John Smith had explored by sea the coast of New England from Penobscot Bay to Cape Cod. Smith, one of the 105 original settlers of Jamestown and a leading force in the English settlement of North America, had also charted Virginia and the Chesapeake Bay. He did this work both in Virginia and New England with the intention of enticing settlers, noting the prospects for enrichment from fish, salt, fruit, precious metals, furs, and even the possibility of producing silk. Although known for a swaggering, boastful nature, Smith described the riches of these new lands with a notable restraint. By the early 17th century, a considerable literature on the wealth of the Americas had already accumulated, and most of it was outrageously exaggerated to the point where, Smith observed, settlers would quickly leave in disappointment. And so he resolved to be a realist, though his trademark style could be seen in naming Cape Ann after a woman he had been fond of during his military service in Turkey. Back in England, it was renamed Cape Ann after Prince Charles's mother. Although personally disliking fishing, Smith understood that if it was a profitable endeavor, it would attract settlers. Herring, cod, and ling is that triplicity that makes their wealth and shipping's multiplicities such as it is, he wrote in his unmusical prose, and devoted several pages in his description of New England to describing the wealth various nations had garnered from these fish. He demonstrated his point with characteristic flair by ordering his crew to fish and salt cod while he was exploring coastlines, then earning a modest but widely reported fortune selling the salt cod in England and Spain. Smith also understood the importance of salt to his dream of a British America. He had established salt works in Jamestown in 1607. As he sailed the rocky coastline of New England, he noted places that seemed suitable harbors, but also locations that seemed favorable for salt making. He thought conditions were suitable for white-on-white, re-evaporating sea salt the way the English improved French bay salt. He thought that Plum Island, just north of Cape Ann, would be a particularly good site for a salt works. In his list of 25 excellent good harbors for fishing, he completely ignored the best harbor on Cape Ann, which only 9 years later would become the fishing station of Gloucester, and eventually the leading cod port of New England. Smith's description of New England was an important factor in the Pilgrims' decision to go to New England, and when they arrived, they found Smith's portrait to be accurate. They were, as promised, in a land of cod where salt could be made. Though they accepted the royal name, Cape Ann, they used Smith's name for Cape Cod, a name originated by his fellow Jamestown founder, Bartholomew Gosnold, because they intended, like Smith, to amass wealth from fishing. In 1630, the Reverend Francis Higginson wrote in New England Plantation, "There is probability that the country is of an excellent temper for the making of salt." But the Pilgrims had no idea how to make it, and for that matter, they didn't know how to catch fish either. Governor William Bradford of Plymouth Colony sent to England for advisors on fishing, salt making, and shipbuilding. Within a few years, the colony began to thrive on fishing, but it was still limited by salt supply. The salt advisor tried to make bay salt in the French manner, digging evaporation ponds lined with clay, but New England weather was ill-suited to this technique. According to Bradford, the saltmaker was an ignorant, foolish, self-willed fellow. Massachusetts, like Queen Elizabeth, encouraged salt-making through the granting of monopolies to those who showed the skill to produce salt cheaply. The colony granted Samuel Winslow a 10-year monopoly to employ his ideas on salt-producing, which is considered the first patent issued in America. The same year, John Jenny was given exclusive salt-making rights in Plymouth for 21 years. Salt works were started in Salem, Salisbury, and Gloucester. Salt was needed not only for fish exports, but also for furs. The settlers traded with the Native Americans for bear, beaver, moose, and otter pelts, for which there was a lucrative European market. Because furs were salted, they were frequently exported on the same ships as cod. But to get the indigenous people to produce more furs, the British had to supply them with more salt. The New England household also needed a great deal of salt for domestic purposes. The typical colonial New England house, the New England salt box, got its name from being shaped like the salt containers that were in every home. New Englanders slaughtered their meat in the fall and salted it. They ate New England boiled dinner, which was either salt cod or salt beef with cabbage and turnips. They also ate a great deal of salted herring, though they seem to have preferred lightly salted and smoked red herring, perhaps because of their limited salt supply. When these early settlers hunted, they would leave red herring along their trail because the strong smell would confuse wolves, which is the origin of the expression red herring, meaning a false trail. Wealthy Virginians imported enormous amounts of English salt beef in spite of raising their own cattle. They regarded the British beef as better cured, perhaps because the British had ample salt. But Virginians made some salt of their own and imported more from England. They built a cottage industry of salted pork fat, and by the time of the American Revolution, Virginia hams were famous and exported not only to other colonies from New York to Jamaica, but even to England. During the Revolution, when it was a part of the provisions of the Continental Army, Virginia ham earned the admiration of the French, which is always considered high praise for a ham. In 1781, the Comte de Rochambeau, a French hero of the American Revolution and later tyrant of the Haitian Revolution, while engaged in the Virginia campaign, said that French ham cannot be compared to the quality and taste of theirs. This undated recipe from Charlotte County, Virginia, is believed to have been used by the Jefferson family at Monticello. Baked spiced ham. Select a nicely cured ham. Soak overnight in cold water. Wipe off and put on in enough water to cover. Simmer for 3 hours. Let cool in the water it was cooked in. Take out and trim. Put into baking pan, stick with cloves, and cover with brown sugar. Bake in moderate oven for 2 hours. Baste with white wine. Serve with a savory salad. For a while, the American colonists pursued their own salt-making with characteristic self-reliance, producing a significant amount. But the securing of these colonies by the British had coincided with the discovery of rock salt in Cheshire and its increased production. In time, the British made Liverpool salt cheaper and more accessible than local salt, and domestic American production dropped off. This was exactly the way colonialism was supposed to work. While relations were intact with England, the colonists had enough salt for their domestic needs, but the salt supply was inhibiting their foreign trade. Of course, they were not supposed to be engaging in foreign trade. They were supposed to buy everything from England and sell everything to England. But the American colonists produced more, especially more salt cod than the British could sell. As long as the Americans were making their products with British salt, the British were happy to let them overproduce. But the British often failed to supply enough salt for American needs. In 1688, Daniel Cox wrote about New Jersey that fish were abundant, but the colony was unable to establish a successful fishery because of a want of salt. The New Jersey colony sent to France for experts, diverse Frenchmen skillful in making salt by the sun. This was not how colonialism was supposed to work. The American colonies, especially the two most productive, Virginia and Massachusetts, became accustomed to selling their products around the Atlantic world. New England began by selling salted cod and salted furs, but soon was selling manufactured goods, buying iron and Mediterranean products in the Basque port of Bilbao, selling cod for slaves in West Africa, slaves for molasses in the Caribbean, rum made from molasses in West Africa. By the early 1700s, Boston merchants did not feel that they needed England anymore. In one important respect, they were wrong. Despite increasingly independent and sophisticated transatlantic commerce, they still depended on England for salt. New Englanders occasionally imported salt from other countries. Ships selling cod to Bilbao would pick up salt from southern Spain at Cadiz or Portuguese salt at Lisbon. But in 1775, like exemplary British colonists, the Americans were still relying on British salt, either Cheshire salt from Liverpool or sea salt from the British colonies, especially Great Inagua, Turk Island, and Salt Key. Tom Paine's contention that a continent obviously could not be ruled by an island was increasingly resonating among the merchant class. In 1759, the British, sensing that American trade was leading to American independence, started imposing punitive tariffs, taxes, and other measures designed to inhibit American trade. The Americans responded angrily, and the British responded with even harsher measures. In 1775, the atmosphere was so embittered that the British thought it necessary to place 3,000 troops in rebellious Boston under Major General Thomas Gage. When these soldiers attempted to spread out into the countryside, Americans went into armed rebellion, firing on the British troops at Concord and Lexington on April 19th. The Continental Congress, first called in 1774 as a protest, convened in May 1775 to prepare for war. In June, while the Congress was still meeting, the rebels marched on Boston, and Gage committed all but 500 of his troops to a battle on Breed's Hill above Boston Harbor. Although the British objective of holding Boston was accomplished, Gage lost more than 40% of his soldiers in this engagement. Incorrectly known as the Battle of Bunker Hill, this was to be the worst British loss of the war. In the summer of 1775, the British declared the colonies in open rebellion and responded with a naval blockade, causing an immediate and serious salt shortage, not only for the fisheries, but for the soldiers, horses, and medical supplies of George Washington's Continental Army. In addition to the blockade, British ground forces isolated the mid-Atlantic colonies from their two sources of American salt, New England and the South. They even attacked and destroyed mid-Atlantic salt works. After the Bunker Hill debacle, Gage was replaced as commander of British forces in America by General William Howe, an illegitimate relative of the royal family. In 1758, Howe had been elected a member of Parliament and had opposed measures against American commerce, fearing British policy would lead to a loss of the colonies. Now he was ordered to hold them by force. In August 1776, he took Long Island and then New York City. The next year, he drove Washington from Philadelphia. At this point in the war, he had successfully cut off Washington's army from its coastal salt supply and even captured Washington's salt reserves, despite the American general's desperate dispatch warning, "Every attempt must be made to save it." The American colonists initially responded to the British blockade by boiling seawater. But boiling used up an enormous quantity of wood to make a very small amount of salt. About 400 gallons of seawater were needed to make one bushel of salt. In the winter, families would keep an iron cauldron of seawater cooking over the household fire, which was not a great additional expense, since the fire was burning continuously anyway to heat the house. But only a small amount of salt was produced this way. Salt makers drove wooden stakes into tidal pools, and salt would crystallize on the wood as the pools evaporated. This technique was inexpensive, but also yielded little. The Continental Congress passed several measures addressing the salt shortage. On December 29, 1775, the Congress earnestly recommended to the several assemblies and conventions to promote by sufficient public encouragement the making of salt in their respective colonies. In March 1776, Pennsylvania Magazine published a lengthy excerpt from Brownrigg's essay on making bay salt. The article was reprinted as a pamphlet and circulated by the Congress. On May 28, 1776, the Congress decided to give a bounty of one-third of a dollar per bushel, which weighs about 50 pounds, to all salt importers or manufacturers in the colonies for the next year. The moment the pamphlet and bounty offer were published, salt works were started along the American coastline. New Jersey had contemplated establishing a state-operated salt works, but so many private ones were built along its coast in 1777 that it canceled these plans as unnecessary. In June 1777, a congressional committee was appointed to devise ways and means of supplying the United States with salt. 10 days later, the committee proposed that each colony could offer financial incentives to both importers and producers of salt. Some of the 13 colonies had already been doing this. New Jersey declared that any salt work could exempt up to 10 employees from military service. One of the many sea salt operations to start up in response to the government's publication of the Brownrigg pamphlet and bounty offer was the first salt works on Cape Cod. Given the cod fishing communities and the presence of sea and wind, Cape Cod was a logical place to make salt. The water both on the bay side and in Nantucket Sound is even saltier than that of the open Atlantic. The first works was started in the town of Dennis by John Sears, who spent his days so lost in thought that he was known as Sleepy John Sears. The neighbors were skeptical of the 10-by-100-foot wooden vat Sleepy John built in Sesuit Harbor. The vat leaked, and after many weeks he had produced only 8 bushels of salt. The neighbors laughed, but Sleepy John Sears spent the winter caulking the vat as a ship's hull would be sealed. In the summer of 1777, a time of great salt scarcity, he produced 30 bushels of salt, and his neighbors stopped laughing, and Sleepy John became known as Salty John Sears. The following year, the British man of war, the Somerset, ran aground trying to round the Cape. The coastline was poorly marked, and scavenging shipwrecks was a strong local tradition. Sears took the Somerset's bilge pump to fill his vats. But even with the bilge pump, producing Sears's salt required a great deal of heavy manual labor, and only wartime prices made this high-cost salt economically viable. Then a man named Nathaniel Freeman from nearby Harwich suggested that Sears use windmills to pump seawater. The same thing had been done in 8th-century Sicily, in Frapani, but Cape Codders thought this was a brilliant new idea. Soon the wooden skeletons of rustic windmills were seen on the edges of most Cape Cod towns. The windmills, known as salt mills, pumped seawater through pipes, lead-lined, hollow pine logs, to the evaporation pans. But in a climate where solar evaporation was viable only in the summer months, the hardship of wartime made this operation profitable. And still these rebel colonies could not produce enough salt to meet their needs. Fishermen with catches to be salted, and farmers with pigs and cattle to slaughter and salt before winter, hoped for a short war. But that was not to be. By the time it ended with the Treaty of Paris in September 1783, the American Revolution would be, until Vietnam, the longest war ever fought by the United States. A new nation was born with the bitter memory of what it meant to depend on others for salt. Chapter 14. Liberté, égalité, tax breaks. In 1875, a prominent German botanist named Matthias Jacob Schleiden wrote a book, Das Salz, which contended that there was a direct correlation between salt taxes and despots. He pointed out that neither ancient Athens nor Rome, while it remained a republic, taxed salt, but listed Mexico and China among the salt-taxing tyrannies of his day. It seems uncertain if salt taxes are always an accurate litmus test for democracy, but the French salt tax, the gabelle, clearly demonstrated what was wrong with the French monarchy. The argument for the gabelle had been that since everyone, rich and poor, used salt more or less equally, a tax on salt would be, in effect, a poll tax, an equal tax per person. Throughout history, poll taxes, charging the same to the poorest peasant as the richest aristocrat, have been the most hated. The gabelle was not an exception. The tax performed the peculiar service of making a very common product seem rare because the complex rules of taxation inhibited trade. And even more infuriating, the gabelle made a basic product expensive for the profit of the crown. Even the crown's claim that the gabelle was fair because it taxed everyone equally was not true.